Hi everyone, and welcome to the sixth episode of the Cancer Researcher podcast, brought to you by the European Association for Cancer Research. In this episode, let's talk about grant applications, part 2. We will continue our conversation starting in episode 4 about research funding and grant applications. I am your host, Dr. Alexandra Bojtov, Scientific Officer at the EACR, and a former early career researcher myself. And as a reminder, my guests for this episode are Dr. Ryan Schoenfeld, CEO of the Mark Foundation for Cancer Research, a philanthropic organization dedicated to transforming the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer around the world. An experienced scientific leader, Ryan oversees the foundation's scientific programs, investments, and operations. Dr. Greg Hennen, Professor of Molecular Cancer Biology and Director of the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute at the University of Cambridge, who has recently won a grant from the Cancer Grant Challenges offered by Cancer Research UK and the National Cancer Institute. And Dr. Arianna Bagiolini, Assistant Professor at the Institute of Oncology Research in Switzerland. She recently obtained an SMSF starting grant for her research, a funding scheme in Switzerland covering the ERC starting grants, as well as the former SNSF funding schemes Excellenza and FIMA.
Hello, everyone. And Arianna, Ryan, and Greg, thank you very much for joining me again on the EACR podcast to continue our conversation about grant applications.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks.
Yes, thank you.
We've recently had a really interesting conversation about grant applications, and you've given some brilliant advice to our listeners. And today, I would like to continue that conversation. I want to highlight for our listeners that this is a very general approach to grant writing. And as we've mentioned in the previous episode, there would be some differences in how one should best approach an application depending on the funding body. So what would be the best approach, in your opinion, to searching for the most appropriate grant for the application that you have in mind?
I think most places will have a grants office, a grants and contracts office, and they very often have people who, you know, kind of do horizon scanning and watch the landscape. And so many of them are quite proactive. I know my own institution, we get an email probably weekly with available funding opportunities. And, you know, if that doesn't happen at the institution where any of our listeners are, then I would advise going and getting in touch with the grants office, because they very often have connections that allow them to monitor opportunities across the landscape.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. I just can speak from our perspective of the Mark Foundation that when we launch a new program, new funding program, or a new call for an existing program, we tend to reach out to as many institutional offices as we have a distribution list for that. And so we make them aware. And so we know that they're aware of that. But also, you know, I'm not sure if all the non-governmental funding opportunities that are out there do that are foundation-based. So it doesn't hurt to check, to scan the websites of various foundations as well. We always post ours on our website.
Yeah, definitely. And then I think you should also keep in mind at which career stage you are and for which grants you are eligible. So, you know, there are several grants for which you can apply already as an advanced postdoc that will help you in the transition towards independence. So it's worth even giving a look at those, because it will make your profile so much more attractive to institutions if you manage to get one of these independence grants. So think about your career stage, and there are often some grants that are specific for your stage. And those are usually, especially for young researchers, the best fit often.
On that note, I would like to mention that the EACR also offers postdoctoral fellowships, which are awarded for a period of up to 3 years and support excellent postdoctoral researchers in laboratories throughout Europe. Please visit our website at www.eacr.org/eacr-fellowship to find out more. On our website, you can find out when new calls for postdoctoral fellowships will be open, as well as more information about the application process and eligibility criteria. Are there any downsides of getting maybe a bit ahead of yourself and applying for a grant that's possibly a bit more competitive than you expected if you don't get it? Would that somehow temper with your ability to apply to other grants or to use the same idea to apply to other grants or reapply to the same scheme later on?
I don't think there's really any negative impact of doing that, except, you know, that the disappointment that you suffer if you don't get it. I mean, I think there's an interesting aspect to your question, which is, you know, as a more junior researcher, when should you apply for grants? And, you know, people give very different advice. I've heard people tell starting investigators not to bother, you know, not to waste their time in the first few years when they already have some support that might be institutional or a startup package or, you know, and to wait until they're at a slightly later stage and sort of have their lab more developed. I actually think it's quite the opposite. And there's a couple of reasons for that. So first of all, you know, you leave your postdoc, you get an independent position. You've likely had some strong publications track record as a postdoc that landed you that position. And there will be a honeymoon period of about 2-3 years when there won't be an expectation that you will have accomplished a tremendous amount as an independent investigator yet. And you'll be judged sort of on the work that you did in your sort of supported position as a postdoc. And so I think, you know, from the perspective of track record, you should take advantage of that period. And the other thing that I would say about grant writing in general, and I don't remember if this came up in the last episode, but I think the exercise of writing a grant focuses your mind and forces you to think about your projects and your goals with a clarity beyond what you would necessarily do potentially, unless you're a very, very strategic person, you know, without having been forced to kind of write it down in a way that you could defend to others. And so I think that that sort of focusing the mind really can help you sort of hone project. And so I think just the act of doing it is an advantage, even at a very early stage.
Yeah, you mentioned this thing in the previous episode, and since I had a question on my mind, so in one of the other episodes from this podcast, we discussed about the challenges of becoming a PI, and the news usually comes with you having to learn a lot of new skills, which also takes a lot of your time. So do you have any advice on how one could determine they're not taking up too much load if they already have one grant application, then the commitments that come with that, and then they have to learn new skills like leadership skills, manage other people, possibly for the first time, and then thinking ahead and trying to apply for new grants?
There's a lot of pieces to that question. I think starting your own group is probably one of the hardest things you ever do in science, because as you say, you know, you're making a transition, needing to learn loads of new skills, everything from leadership and personnel management to financial management and, you know, strategic planning. But again, I don't see the grant writing process as a distraction from that. I see it as a mechanism, right? You think about where you want to take your lab over the next whatever period of time. You know, so I think starting junior group leaders are generally pretty busy, but for the most part, there is a selection bias for, you know, people who are usually quite high energy. So I've not ever seen a circumstance where I felt someone was spending too much time in the act of writing grants, or even, you know, just the corresponding piece of thinking about their projects and their future.
Yes, I totally agree with you. You know, I just opened my lab less than a year ago, so I'm still learning how to juggle all these new responsibilities. And I think it's actually helping to write grants and have a clear mind about the projects that you are planning ahead. And of course, you have to have a compromise. So you have a starting package. So you have a bit of security that allows you to do your research. So you don't have to invest 100% of your energy on in writing grants, but to have a balance between lab work, managing the lab and the finances, and starting thinking ahead. So what are the next experiments, the next projects? And I agree with Greg, you get a clarity that otherwise you don't easily get, or at least I don't easily get, except when I sit down and I really think, okay, this is what I want to do. How do I do it?
And I would imagine writing, I mean, just like any writing, you know, your skills improve the more you write, the more you do it. So I think there's no waiting to start writing grants as soon as possible. In developing that skill, you'll get better at it over time.
Yeah. And in that sense, I think it helps a lot when you start applying for grants already as a postdoc. So as a postdoctoral fellow, getting fellowships and potentially already planning for independence awards, that gets you used to writing your thoughts in a cleared way. And is a skill that you have to train, definitely.
It just is kind of an anecdote, right? So I happened to meet yesterday in town, a former PhD student, and she was in town and talk. And so we kind of met up, and, you know, she was talking about the early phases of her lab and, you know, saying, oh, you know, I've got some students who have projects that are not very good. And in the future, I'm just going to definitely make sure everybody has a very good project. And she's in a situation where she didn't have to write grants. And, you know, we talked a little bit about it. And I think if she had to go through the process of defending those projects to somebody else, you know, she might have made different choices. And the problem is, once you get a student started on something, there's a certain distance along, you know, even if you sort of lose enthusiasm for something, you know, they've got to finish a thesis.
Yeah.
And so I think, to me, that's just kind of further evidence that, you know, that the intellectual part of the process is just really important.
Yeah, it makes sense.
In the previous episode, we briefly discussed the stages of planning for writing a grant proposal. And towards the end of the episode, you gave our listeners some tips on how to write the abstract for a proposal. Now, once you've prepared, it's time to get writing. Obviously, there will be some difference in the requirements from one funding scheme to another. But I believe most of them follow a fairly common format. Generally, you would have to give a summary of the project at the very beginning. Then there will be some background information section to place your work in context. Then a separate section for your own previous work. Then one section for preliminary work, which directly informs your project. Followed by the main bulk of the proposal, like a detailed explanation of what you're actually going to do. And then usually it ends up with a cost breakdown, plus more administrative documents like CVs, which, although a part of the funding decision, are beyond the scope of our conversation today. Would you agree that this sums up the process in general?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But then I think it's also worth mentioning that with some applications, you also have like a more free format. I think that's the approach that the Mark Foundation takes, right, Brian?
Yeah, so it depends on the program, but most of our applications have some flexibility how you would choose. You know, we give you a page length limit typically, just to, we found if we didn't do that, we got very, very, very long applications sometimes, which are great to read, but sometimes can be hard to review. I mean, the prompts that we give are that we want, I think we talked about this last time, but really it's important to understand what question you're trying to answer, what the impact of the work will be. And that should be in the abstract. It should also be at the top of the meat of the application in the summary section. And it should be sprinkled throughout as like in the experimental sections where you're describing how you're going to do what you do. I think kind of summarizing at the end, again, coming back to what the impact of this will be. Great to see, you know, what's an expected outcome, but also what are some other ways this could go, to see that you've thought through, you know, that these experiments, if they're going. So that's an important part too. I think what you do kind of towards the end of the grant, before you get to the budget part, kind of talking through the experiments and thinking it through where this might lead. We all realize this is research. It might not work out as exactly as planned. And you can't anticipate everything when you're writing the application, but it's helpful for reviewers to see that you're thoughtful about that, about, you know, where things might go. So I'd be mindful to include that. But back to your question in terms of format, yeah, we try to keep it, we try to keep a good balance between giving the applicants a great opportunity to convey what they want to do and why they want to do it, how they want to do it, and what the impact will be. Also, you know, we try to get peer expert reviewers who are quite busy, but also really have deep expertise in the areas that are relevant to the grant. And so balancing the time of those things, we try to keep the application form minimalist if we can, but still need some details.
So Ryan, on the reviewer angle, you know, I imagine probably the Mark Foundation experience is a little bit different, but you know, I've had reviews and sat on many panels where, you know, basically it's very difficult to please everyone because you're going to have a set of reviewers who are just incredibly conservative.
Yes.
And, you know, basically wants you to apply for money to do something that, you know, you've basically already finished. And you have another group that are wanting to see blue skies, big ideas, adventurous questions and experiments. And, you know, I just wonder what your experience was and what sorts of strategies you've seen for people to deal with that kind of reviewer spectrum.
Yeah, that's a great question, Greg. So the experience we have on our panels, you know, one thing we try to do is before the panels discuss, right, or even before they review sometimes, we'll give them a prompt that, you know, this is what our foundation is interested in. And we found this, I don't know if it's a niche is the right way to call it, but we found this place in the world where we think we want to find some research that maybe some of the other organizations that are looking for more well-established preliminary data sets, let's say. You know, so it's not that we don't want to see any preliminary data. Of course we do, and it's great if you have it, but we're excited about new ideas and we want to see, we want to fund research that has high impact potential and it's not incrementally. Because the problem, I think, is when you're too conservative, the research that you get funded, number one, it's probably already done by the time it gets funded. And number two, it can be incremental, right? It builds, that's not always a bad thing, but it methodically tends to build off of itself. And we're trying to accelerate things with kind of bold leaps. And if it doesn't work, great, try something else. So we give that prompt. So we ask our reviewers to keep that in mind when they review, but we absolutely get a full spectrum of people who are kind of on both ends and places in between, as you mentioned, Greg. So advice for applicants would be, I guess for the Mark Foundation, I would still err on the side of being bold and reaching for impact, but do bear in mind some reviewers, even on our panels, will be looking for preliminary data, proof that's going to work. What the best thing that we can try to do is, we have a sense of you know, which reviewers fall into which group, and we try to balance the panels out so that we have at least some of, you know, some of each. And we have lively discussions on the panels while we're reviewing the grants, but we do try to encourage people to take more leaps and to really be bolder. So we try to encourage our reviewers to embrace that as well.
But then what would you say is more important when applying for a grant? Having a novel, groundbreaking, but still feasible idea, or an outstanding track record as a researcher?
For me, that's the idea. I want you to have a great question, right? What are you trying to solve for? What's the problem? And then you have an interesting or novel or innovative solution to try to attempt to solve that. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's broadly applicable advice. I think there's some other programs where you should probably emphasize the preliminary data that you have and, you know, the likelihood of success of where you're going. I think the impact should always be important, right? That's going to be critical in any grant program. But so read the room, I guess, too, whatever program you're applying to and who you're applying to.
Well, I think early career, it's hard to read the room.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I can tell you for my first probably 8 or 9 years, every grant application I put in, you know, always came back from one reviewer with the criticism that this is too ambitious. And I guess I sort of developed a strategy, right, which is to put a section at the end of each aim and at the end of the grant, you know, that said, this is our direction travel. This is this sort of big idea. And, you know, I don't know if we'll get there. But, you know, I used to call it something like outlook or, you know, summary and future plans or something like this. And I think that helped because all of the reviewers who thought it was too ambitious said, okay, you know, these guys understand their limitations. And then for the ones who wanted something kind of a bit bolder, they could look at that and say, oh, okay, at least they understand what the bold idea is. And so I think particularly for people starting out where track records aren't as well established, developing strategies to mitigate those, you know, those reviewer extremes, I think is really important. Ariana, have you had any experience like that?
Yeah, totally. So in both directions, you know, I got already my first grants rejected because too ambitious, and some that got accepted. And there I always try to be very transparent with the limitation of the study and the potential technical issues that could arise. So I think it's really important to show that you thought about your experiment and about the weakness of your work and that you are trying to compensate for it. So you are ready, you have a plan B in case your fantastic plan is fading for some technical reason, you have a backup plan. And I think it's important exactly to not hide it, but really instead really highlight it and explain that you have a backup, you are ready for that. And really show transparency in that direction. But, you know, I'm going to try your strategy for the comment of proposing two ambitious projects. I like the idea. I will try that.
I think one thing I'd add about the critique you get back about being too ambitious, I think there's kind of, there's two flavors of that. And at least for us, one flavor is okay and one is less so. The one flavor that where it's more that the scope of the experiments proposed is just totally inconsistent with the budget and framework of the grant, right? We see that sometimes, and just that kind of ambition, it can be a misfire, I would say, because then clearly it's not clear to the funder, okay, is there other funding coming into this? Because there have to be to do these experiments. What is it? And if that's not made clear, there's questions then about how you're going to, about just, you know, tractability, right, of getting these experiments done. The other kind of ambitious is like, okay, there's no way you're going to do that in 3 years, but maybe you will. Like, I mean, that's like, you know, will you get to that or not? And it's just an ambitious set of, but it's not necessarily mismatched for the budget and scope, maybe a little bit, but not in a big way. It's more just about that kind, at least from our perspective as a funder, we appreciate that even. That demonstrates some ambition, some energy. I think some acknowledgement of the risk is important to put in there that you might not get this done. Or, you know, some way to word that along the lines of what Greg mentioned would be great to see. But I think, there's kind of two kinds of too ambitious, and I would certainly lean into the latter.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I understand from you is that it's great to have a very ambitious idea as long as you are aware of time and resources when you write your application.
And the risks, I think, demonstrate the risk, you know, being somewhat realistic about understanding what may or may not happen. I think, you know, at least for us, I mean, the blue sky camp wins a little bit, I would say, between the two camps, right? And that's not true everywhere. But I think, you know, we having some vision and having some, you know, seeing where this work is going, even if it extends beyond the scope of the program at hand, I think it's nice to see.
And do you have any tips on how one could balance the ambition and creativity and to some extent, possibly even the fear of missing out and the part where you still need to keep realistic to some extent?
I'm not sure what you mean by fear of missing out.
What I had in mind is that when you write an application, maybe at some point you hold back from what you would want to achieve from that project because maybe you're concerned you're becoming too ambitious or you will be criticized for that.
Yeah, again, it's a balance. You know, you'd sort of hate to think that, you know, people really hold back their good ideas very often. It might be more there about maybe finding the right funder rather than saying, well, I can't say that I'm going to do that because they'll never believe I could do it. So that's where I think if you do have something that's, you know, quite high risk, there are sources of money that let you at least, you know, get some pilot data. Often institutions will have pump priming schemes. Cancer centers will have pump priming schemes. There are a number of funders that have, you know, kind of very short-term awards, a year, 2 years, you know, for not all that much money, but it might be enough to get you kind of over the hump in terms of having enough data that you'll convince reviewers that what you're proposing is feasible. So thinking about maybe doing it in stages and taking it a little bit less money up front, with the idea that you're going to build the package that you need to go for something a bit larger.
And apart from your CV and track record, are there any maybe more out-of-the-box way that you could show that you are indeed the best person to tackle the problem that you propose to solve?
Oh, that's a really hard one. It depends a little bit, in my mind, on whether there is an in-person component to things. So there are a lot of applications where, you know, it's a 2 or 3 step process where, you know, there's an application on paper, but then, you know, there's also an interview process. And I think that's where you get an opportunity to really show that you're the person to do this, right? To really convince them. Sometimes it's a lot easier to do that in person.
And what is expected at the interview? What should one prepare? Is it usually like a presentation, or are you going through your proposal?
It's different depending on the funder. So, you know, I did a lot of work with the DoD, and, you know, in there, what you were really doing was, for a lot of the large awards, it was a sanity check on just how convincing the individual was. When I ran the Innovator Awards for the innovation, the Small Innovation Awards for CRUK, you know, there was, we often, I mean, it was a program that was really designed to fund crazy ideas. It was a 2-year, £200,000. It was called the Pioneer Award. And, you know, there we just wanted to get somebody in a room and really try to pick the crazy idea apart in a way that, you know, you couldn't do in a proposal. And the one thing that always worked in those settings was props. So if you came in with a prop, you know, just historically, your odds of actually, you know, prevailing went up quite significantly, because it's, you know, something you could, if you were fabricating something, so you could pass it around the room, you could kind of feel it. And then, you know, so I just did a Wellcome Trust Discovery Award, and, you know, that again was a presentation and a chance for the panel to ask questions and kind of dig in to the application. And in that one, and in the Grand Challenge that I've led, there was really a component of, in sort of team awards, how does the team work together? You know, you can always tell when you get a team in a room that's proposing to do a piece of science together, you know, just from how they interact, you know, whether it's really going to be a team effort, or whether it's, you know, these guys are going to go take money and scurry off into their corners and do what they would have done anyways. So again, it depends on scale, setting, and the kind of grant it is.
And in that interview, like when you get to the interview, should you bring up what you think to be the weak point of your proposal to show that you're aware and that you have a plan to tackle those? Or is it safer to not mention them unless asked about it?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think, you know, you have to remember that during those interview, you have a limited time. So you should focus on giving a clear message, and especially focus on the importance of your work and on the plan. I think not because you should hide the weakness of the project, but just because the time is limited and you have a limited span of attention from the reviewers that are there in the room with you, you should try to catch their attention and their curiosity. And there you have usually, exactly depending on the context, you might have the chance to tell about your scientific journey. So you should rather have the chance to talk about that instead of really highlighting the weaknesses. So tell about how you develop the skills, why you are the person that is the most appropriate person to address the fantastic project that you are proposing, and the journey that allowed you to collect the skills to address it. But yeah, because the time is limited, I think one should use it wisely and really highlight the importance of the project and the strengths.
The other thing I'll say about weaknesses is that both in written and oral presentations, and I shouldn't say this with a funder here, but you know, you want to make sure that you're able to turn every weakness into a strength, right? So, you know, you don't want to highlight a weakness that's really a weakness.
Yeah. That's a good point. I think be ready to answer. If you're presenting, you probably, I would agree, don't present it unless you could do a great set and kind of proactively present it as a strength. Just be ready to answer questions. So you'll probably get, if it's a clear weakness, you know, or it's a clear risk, let's say, just be ready to answer questions, because the institute committee's probably picked up on that too. So they may ask you. So as long as, and they'll appreciate that you were ready to answer that question, that you were waiting for that. And if you could do what Greg said and kind of turn it into a strength in your answer, that's even better.
Fingers crossed, all these tips combined in addition to our listeners' own brilliant ideas will bring them closer to winning that funding they've been dreaming of. Is there anything else you would like to add? Any ideas you think we might have missed in our conversations?
No, maybe just don't take it personal if you get rejected. Just keep going. And it's also a number game. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to circle back to that point as well. And it's because it's sort of where you started. And I think it's true. You should never take it personally. But I think you should allow yourself a day to be disappointed or pissed off or whatever you're going to be, right? Because, you know, that's a natural part of the process. But then, you know, you get out of bed the next day and you got to move on and, you know, be positive about the next one.
Good advice.
At this point, I would like to thank you very much for sharing your views and your advice. It was a pleasure chatting with you. And I'm sure this is going to prove to be very, very helpful for our listeners. So I want to thank you again for joining me on this podcast.
Thank you, Alexandre.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Take care.
We really hope that you enjoyed listening to Ariana's, Greg's, and Ryan's advice, inspired by their own experiences submitting or receiving grant applications. I would like to once again thank our guests for being here with me today, and many thanks to everyone who listened. Please subscribe to our podcast so you wouldn't miss an episode. You can find the Cancer Researcher podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts as always, but now we're also on Audible, Amazon, and Google Podcasts. Please do us a favor, subscribe to our podcast and tell your friends about it. And don't forget to tune in on the 1st of November for the next episode to find out how to increase the impact of your research beyond the publication impact factor. You can give us feedback or offer suggestions for other topics or preferred guests through our feedback form that you can find on our website at www.eacr.org/podcast. That's www.eacr.org/podcast. And don't forget that you can also find us on Twitter at EACR News, Instagram at Hello EACR, and you can search for us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Have a nice day.